Good morning. I'm glad to be here. Please turn to John 12. I'm thinking I may be in line for the dubious honor of having the most protracted sermon series on record here. I've had in mind to invite other pastors to help me out in this book study, but only recently got around to formally doing so. I think a number of them may take me up on this, so I'm grateful. It's not that I'm tired of the Gospel of John. It's just that, well, a series can be a little meaningless if the segments are so far apart that you lose all sense of connection between the intervals. I told you last Sunday that my text this morning was going to be John 11, 45 to 47. I realize now I told you to turn to John 12. Actually, that was John 11 that I'm going to tell you to turn to. First section, John 11, 45 to 7 to 57, sorry, and chapter 12, verses 37 to 50. I decided that the disadvantage of taking the second one out of sequence was outweighed by the advantage of pulling these two together because of their similar content. In both of these, John is, again, recording the response of people who encountered Jesus. In both of these, in both, he includes these characteristic parenthetical explanations to the reader, and in both, he includes the foundational themes and truths that he has brought to us over and over from the beginning of the book, and that tie the book together. And always, always, he crafts his retelling with one basic purpose in mind, and you know what that is. But these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing, you may have life in his name. With a few small exceptions, all the themes we'll see in this passage are themes we've covered in depth and repeatedly in the past. Let me start with an overview. Here is how I analyzed the first passage, except for the two parenthetical explanations and one note about Jesus' withdrawal. This passage is a listing of various responses that people were making to what Jesus had been saying and doing. We'll come back to those momentarily. In the last part of chapter 12, or almost the last part, John gives another parenthetical explanation with a reference to Isaiah's prophecy. He also records two more responses, and he wraps up with quoting Jesus in a short, powerful discourse that in some ways serves as a summary of Jesus' teaching of the last 3 years. And now I have to confess, you notice that last part is not on here. I bit off more than I could chew. This final public discourse at the end of chapter 12 seemed like the time to explore what Jesus said about judging in regards to himself. And that turned into a bigger chunk than I can include this morning. So I will attempt to splice that on another time. Incidentally, I did this work on BibleArc.com. You've heard me say it before, but I encourage you to explore this as a Bible study tool. I've been dreaming of offering a workshop or something to introduce people to it. So if you have any interest in that, please talk to me. I'll start by examining the responses that John records, focusing in particular on the ruling Jews. Then I want to look at John's explanation that cites Isaiah 6. And with my title, you can get a sense of what we'll be wrestling with some more this morning. Responses and choices. God's or ours? That's a question. Let's read now chapter 11, 45 to 50. Many of the Jews, therefore, who had come with Mary, and of course I'm reading out of the ESV. Many of the Jews, therefore, who had come with Mary and had seen what he did, believed in him. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. So the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered the council and said, "What are we to do? For this man performs many signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation." But one of them, Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, said to them, "You know nothing at all, nor do you understand that it is better for you that one man should die for the people, not that the whole nation should perish." He did not say this of his own accord, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the nation, and not for the nation only, but also to gather into one the children of God who are scattered abroad. So from that day on, they made plans to put him to death. It seems a little backwards to include the only positive response right at the start, but that's how John recorded it, and so we'll take it in order. Actually, John didn't say much about this positive response. He simply tells us that Lazarus' resurrection became a powerful motivator for belief, and reasonably so, we say. But it wasn't the only response. Some who observed this had a response that puzzles me. If you had gone to Bethany for the purpose of comforting Mary and Martha, wouldn't you have been thrilled to see them receive the ultimate comfort, the restoration of their beloved brother? And wouldn't you have looked favorably on the one who wrought this restoration? Why the spitefulness? I don't get it, but tattle they did. Some of these went straight to the Pharisees, we're told, and informed them of the happenings. We know by now that John can use several of these titles multiple ways. In this case, it's clear that by referring to the Pharisees, he means those who were in positions of power. Telling them could only mean one thing, and it wasn't to persuade them that Jesus was the Messiah. Does this remind you of another tattletale, also recorded in John? The ungrateful lame man, well, healed lame man, in chapter 5, slipped away to tell the Pharisees so they could add this healing miracle to their record of Jesus' criminal activity. Let's rehearse what we know about the ruling Jews. The Pharisees that John talks about here were a sect that emerged from the reforms of Ezra's day. They were committed adherents to the Hebrew scriptures, and for their diligence had earned a place of leadership in the majority of the synagogues. Because of their influence among the people, they also had a minority hold in the Sanhedrin, the ruling body of 70 members, 70 is what we think it was, that Rome had cautiously established to give the Jews in Palestine a measure of self-rule. The majority party in this council, the Sanhedrin, was the party or sect of the Sadducees. They controlled the temple goings-on, and with their role in the Sanhedrin, they were, according to D.A. Carson, not only the judicial branch, not only the legislative branch, but because of their Rome-appointed, mind you, Rome-appointed high priest, they also filled the executive role in Palestine. How's that for balance of powers? and it seems that they were driven almost exclusively by their love for power and money. So, you can imagine how frightfully they were offended by Jesus' cleansing of the temple. Did I mention that that most of the priests, no, basically all of the priests were Sadducees. Mike Napa offers this fictional narrative of why the priests had it so good. The temple at Jerusalem is bustling with action. Devout Jews are streaming in to make sacrifices required by the law of Moses. A worshiper arrives with an animal. No, the priest says, that animal is unsuitable for sacrifice. You'll have to buy this one from me instead, for a fee. And the implication is that he traded the animal he had for the suitable animal that the priest was selling. Oops, the worshiper presented the wrong currency and now must exchange his money for Jewish shekels, for a fee. And finally, the unreasonably expensive transaction is made. Moments later, another Jew arrives. No, the priest says again. He takes the previously unsuitable livestock and forces the new worshiper to buy it for a fee. And so the cycle repeats itself day after day, year after year. So anyway, here were these ruling Jews with a dilemma on their hands. This miracle-working temple cleanser, disruptor of the status quo, had just outdone himself with restoring to life a decaying corpse. And people were believing in him in increasing numbers. NASB seems to get a little closer in the wording of their question, what are we doing? NIV says, what are we accomplishing? They seem to be awakening to the fact that more radical action will be needed. Notice the unmistakable unsettling that is occurring here. The only reason, I believe, that this could be unsettling is if their power is being threatened. Their conviction about their own power clearly shows in 48. Verse 48, they say, if we let him. So they believed they could control Jesus. They were pretty convinced of their power. What exactly was the perceived threat here? Was it an insurrection? John has again laced his irony into this passage. When they said, our place, they were referring to the temple. Think about it. If everyone had believed in Jesus as the council feared, the fall of Jerusalem wouldn't have happened. Imagine if the Jewish nation would have practiced the Sermon on the Mount. There would not have been a rebellious uprising to quell, and conceivably, both the temple and the nation could have remained. However, for the sake of the argument, let's assume that they were correct in predicting an uprising around this promising figure. How then do we explain their response? They were either convinced that he was not the Messiah, and or they believed that they could decide who was going to be the Messiah. They were missing the truth that Gamaliel challenged them with less than a year after this. But if it is from God, you will not be able to stop these men. You will only find yourselves fighting against God. I think the only reasonable explanation is that their power had blinded them. And there's more. More tragic irony here. As Leslie Newbegin observes, they feared for the temple, not grasping that Jesus himself was the true temple. And then they were planning to destroy him. They also ostensibly feared for the people, not realizing, not understanding that Jesus' mission was indeed to save the people. Their power had not only blinded them, it had corrupted them. up stepped a man with a solution. Caiaphas with characteristically Sadduceical rudeness, told them, "You know nothing at all." There's diplomacy at work. In the Greek, he used a double negative to make this a slap on both cheeks, as it were. Why so forceful, besides that it was his nature? Well, who knows? Perhaps the conversation was going in the direction of some non-lethal means to deal with this problem. If so, Caiaphas was saying, there is only one way to stop him. Kill him. Now, read that again. Whose good was Caiaphas looking out for? Most translations render this, it is better or expedient for you, the King James and some others say for us. Either way, the concern was not for the nation, or at least for the people. It was for the council. They had the most to lose if there was an insurrection and a crackdown from Rome. Consider the oppressive tax structures, for example, or the soldiers' ruthless liberties with the people. Remember the Sermon on the Mount? If he forced you to go 1 mile with him, go with him too. Who was negatively impacted by this? Not the ruling Jews. These powerful people really had no need for a Messiah. They were doing just fine, thank you very much. Well, not really fine, as in the glory days of the empire under David or Solomon, but still, there were perks with being a part of the civilized, cultured, advanced Roman Empire, at least if you were a wealthy ruling Jew. Their power currently came in large part from Rome, as I mentioned. Sure, they didn't want Rome ruling over them, but perhaps it was much like a slave who had been put in charge of other slaves on a southern plantation. A cunning master could give just enough privileges and status to this slave overlord to let him feel some of the power of slave mastering. The result was that he actually emotionally attached to his master, who was, you know, the enemy, and emotionally detached from his fellow slaves. Such seems clearly to have been the case here. But letting the Jews rule themselves, Rome could keep from getting their hands quite as dirty in dealing with these stubborn people, and they could conserve their resources for other matters. It is better for you that one man should die. Caiaphas had absorbed well the political pragmatism that pervaded the Roman Empire and, let me say, has in some degree guided all political entities throughout history, including the governments of our land and our time. This pragmatism says, you do what you have to do to get what you want. If it means killing someone who is a threat, regardless if he has done something wrong or not, you kill him. End of story. And now we move on with our mission. That's political pragmatism. That was the Sadducees. Ugly, right? Really ugly. You know, I've been blasting away at these ruling Jews for a while, and maybe we're feeling kind of good for once. Here's a sin problem that we don't struggle with. We're not crafting legislation, and we stay out of the courts, and we don't bear arms or run for president, so our hands are clean, right? Sure, unless we are the rich and powerful who can insulate ourselves from the desperate struggle for survival, like some of our neighbors near and far. Unless we are the ones who have the buying power to let other people do the dirty work whether on a local or a global scale. I am sure that John would tell us that political pragmatism and living like Jesus don't mix. They're oil and water. Well, no problem, we say. We don't get involved in political pragmatism, right? Okay, I know I'm meddling here, but I don't see how we can get involved in the political process in any way. Voting, campaigning, supporting with our time or money or words. I don't see how we can get involved in any way without becoming a part of the political machinery. And I dare you to find any part of the political machinery in this country or any other that isn't tainted by the political pragmatism that corrupted Caiaphas. The takeaway here is that political pragmatism and Jesus living don't mix. I'm not finished, though. Do we remember that it isn't only what we do that makes us Sadducees or Pharisees? It may well be what we don't do or aren't doing. Many of you heard Reuben Yoder's stirring stories and saw his slides this last week. I was encouraged by the help that he and his teams have been able to give, but I was even more sobered by this tiny window into the massive needs that exist in these parts of the world. We say we can't all get involved like this, and maybe so. But I don't think we'd better consider ourselves off the hook until we have given honest effort to engage in the lives of people like this, and not just a token effort to salve our consciences. I mean an engagement that leaves us feeling what they feel, that has us burdened with the sadness of God, that has us desperately dreaming and strategizing for solutions as if these people were our own flesh and blood. Until we have invested at that level, until our comfortable Western rural Anabaptist insulation is worn off, I don't think we'd better say that we're not control freaks. You see, we probably don't view ourselves as power hungry. But I don't think that we can measure that until our power is threatened. And we know very little about having our power threatened. What is the cure? Well, the first thing that comes to mind is the parable of the sheep and the goats. I also think of the widow's mite. Are we sacrificially investing in the naked, sick, imprisoned, etc.? Another takeaway. We can abuse our power by what we don't do. Please understand, I make no pretense of being guilt-free here. Let me remind us that when we use our power for our own comfort at the expense of other people's comfort, we're doing what the Sadducees did. In our case, I suspect the primary way we use our power is with our money and the resources our money buys, which actually may not be all that different from what the Sadducees did. Now, with my next confession, some of you might bristle and some of you will be sure that I've gone off the deep end, but please let me finish. In the last number of years, I've become increasingly aware that the way I've used our money power Brenda's and mine, has a direct impact on the local poor. I'm referring to our rental investments. In case you hadn't made the connection, investors drive the price up for homeowners. That is a basic principle of free market economies. So when I buy a property that, because it has excellent return on investment, I'm making good use of my money, and I'm making it hard for a person of lesser financial means to go from renting to buying. Oh, don't worry, I know all the reasons why this shouldn't be a problem. The one that we probably go to first is that most of these people aren't capable of being homeowners anyway, even if the price were right. But the reality is that most of us see home ownership as, I should say, we see in general, home ownership to be the better, wiser option, right? And if we dare acknowledge that there are some people out there who could and should be homeowners, then the more I drive the price up, the fewer of those people will become owners. This is one example. I have the feeling there are plenty others. Takeaway. Our use of power, in this case, our money, has consequences for those around us. Now, please hear my rant thoughtfully and read this passage carefully. If I'm misapplying something here, I ask you, please come talk to me. But I've stayed on this long enough. In his parenthetical explanation here, John again points out the irony that the high priest over God's temple is saying these things, never realizing exactly how true his words are. And in verse 53, John completes his report of the council's response to Jesus. Now, if you'd stand, please, for a change of position, I'd like to read the rest of the passage. Verse 54, Jesus therefore no longer walked openly among the Jews, but went from there to a region near the wilderness, to a town called Ephraim, and there he stayed with the disciples. Now the Passover of the Jews was at hand, and many went up from the country to Jerusalem before the Passover to purify themselves. They were looking for Jesus and saying to one another as they stood in the temple, "What do you think? That he will not come to the feast at all?" Now the chief priests and the Pharisees had given orders that if anyone knew where he was, he should let them know so they might arrest him. Thank you. You may be seated. In case we were wondering, John makes it clear, that Jesus isn't a pawn in the council's hand. He knows he is going to the cross, but he will offer himself when the Father directs him. That was the blue. We are approaching now the climactic final week of Jesus' life, and as the crowds built in and around the temple, John records another response. Curiosity. I may be wrong here, but this reminds me of a scenario that we saw too often when we lived in Brooklyn, New York. If you saw a bunch of people, and usually they were junior high age, running from different directions to converge on one spot, you knew they were running to witness the excitement of a fight. I will have to say, that was not the height of human nobility. I have the feeling that these seekers may have been wanting to see some action. Was it to see the ruling Jews again put in their place, like Jesus had done before, or was it to see Jesus brought low? Who knows, but I'm not sure that they were seeking Jesus for honorable reasons. Let's move now to chapter 12. I said verse 37 in what I told you earlier, but the passage probably should start with verse 36b. The sections that we jumped over tell us that Jesus came back from Ephraim to visit with his friends at Bethany. There he joined them for a ceremonial meal. He was invited there. It was in his honor. After which Mary anointed him. The following day was a triumphal entry. John then records Jesus' deep-hearted reflection as he stares his own death in the face. This is followed by a short interchange with his audience, and then that brings us to our passage here, John 12:36b, again out of the ESV. When Jesus had said these things, he departed and hid from them. Though he had done so many signs before them, they still did not believe in him, so that the word spoken by the prophet Isaiah might be fulfilled. Lord, who has believed our report? No, I'm sorry, that's the King James. Lord, who has believed what he heard from us, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? Therefore they could not believe. For again Isaiah said, he has blinded their eyes and hardened their hearts, lest they see with their eyes and understand with their heart and turn, and I would heal them. Isaiah said these things because he saw his glory and spoke of him. Nevertheless, many even of the authorities believed in him, but for fear of the Pharisees, they did not confess it, so they would not be put out of the synagogue. For they loved the glory that comes from man more than the glory that comes from God. In reality, that short the response in verse 37 can't be separated from the other negative responses. I see this as a brief statement, basically as a summary that paves the way for John's musings on how this response fits into the larger picture of the kingdom of God. But before we go to that, I'm going to drop down and catch the last response that John recorded in this passage, cowardly belief. This response raises an interesting question. Was John including the likes of Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea in this group? Ruling Jews who believed in him. I'm a bit doubtful given that he recorded Nicodemus's willingness to stick out his neck back in chapter 7. It was recorded in a positive light. But whoever he's referring to here, this cowardly belief just didn't cut it. John clearly set these rulers in contrast to those stubborn ones who wouldn't believe in verse 37. So I suspect they were moving in the right direction. But what may have seemed like prudence to them, John labeled cowardly dependence on man's approval. Seems probable that John may have had some of his audience in mind when he wrote this. I doubt the problem disappeared after the resurrection of Jesus, do you? I also doubt that it has disappeared in the 2,000 years since the resurrection. You know, I have to say, this isn't as clear-cut for me as I wish it were. Now, I trust I've made a little progress since my days in the fourth grade. Everyone knows, by the way, the proper social structure for grade school, right, Miss Yoder? There are a few in the inner circle at the top, and they're the cool ones. And then there are their buddies right next to them. And then the rest just get scattered out from there and take what they can get. I was never close to the top in the fourth grade or anywhere close or in any of the years following that. And I wanted that most desperately. And I was perplexed how Dale Harrison, the new boy in our class, could jump in and so quickly become part of that inner circle. I decided, with good fourth grade logic, that it must be the way he acted. So if you look at my fourth grade picture, you'll see me trying to smile like Dale did. And if you would have watched me walking down the hall, you would have seen me try to walk like he did. Well, you can guess the rest. It didn't work for me. Now, just for the record, perhaps less than 10 years later, I did an exact about face and decided that it's better to do exactly opposite of what the cool people do. That was probably not the answer either. But let's move beyond some of that childishness, I guess, to the reality that we live in, what do we do with this when we don't think we're doing it about being cool? Most of us recognize the value of identifying with the group we are trying to influence, at least to a point. If it's Rise Kids, we learn to talk their language and take an interest in their world. If we're in Bangladesh, we work hard to respect their customs, even twisted ones like a man showing more affection to his friend than to his wife. I've tried very hard not to be offensive to people that I'm hoping to influence. We say that's accommodation, not acculturation. But can it ever be cowardice or selfishness in other forms? If so, how do we know? Can we trust our hearts? How do we know for sure that we're seeking an ear or a platform, not seeking an audience, not seeking applause or acceptance? I stepped into Wesley Schrock's Bible 1 class the other morning, and I wished I had been there a little earlier. I have no idea what the context was for this, but I heard him pose this question. Suppose it suddenly became popular or acceptable in Western culture for women to cover their hair in a way that we consider biblical. Would it change how we felt about it or how we practiced it? I think if most of us are honest, we'd have to say it probably would. Some of us, of course, claim to be unaffected by cultural pressures and expectations. Frankly, I doubt it. Don't tell me that if you as a child had been dropped into another century or onto another continent, that you would do things just like you do now. Your thought patterns and actions, your mannerisms, your speech, they've all been shaped by your culture, whether you conform to it or react to it. Now, I'm not categorically condemning this, understand. I'm just saying that this is the reality. So how do we deal with this reality? How do we break free from people pressure and follow the call of God? Perhaps if we are truly ruthless with our bent toward self-deception, and if we are brutally honest with those who know us best, and if we circle back to John's critique in verse 33, we might have a chance. It has to be centered on and oriented around a passionate, deliberate pursuit of God's approval. Takeaway. Accommodation and acculturation can look an awful lot alike. In the parenthetical section, starting in verse 38, John digs into another issue that has probably left most of us uncomfortable at some point, and here we're going to get in a little deep. How do we handle the passages that indicate that God hardens people's hearts? Did you notice verse 39? John says they couldn't believe. That's both sobering and uncomfortable. Well, let's first look at it from the human side in this familiar warning from Psalm 95, quoted again in Hebrews several times. Today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as at Meribah, as on the day of Massah in the wilderness, where when your fathers put me to the test and put me to the proof, though they had seen my work. We're used to that. But what do we make of Moses' perspective in Deuteronomy 29? And Moses summoned all Israel and said to them, you have seen all that the Lord did before your eyes in the land of Egypt, to Pharaoh and to all his servants and to all his land, the great trials that your eyes saw, the signs and those great wonders. But to this day, the Lord has not given you a heart to understand or eyes to see or ears to hear. That seems odd, given how scathing Moses' words were earlier when he called them stiff-necked and rebellious. But these apparently contradictory statements mirror what we see elsewhere in Scripture. Should I have devoted a whole message to this issue? Maybe, but the best I can do is just a very cursory look at a few other passages, and then I'll follow with some quotes that have helped me come to a measure of rest on this. If we go back to the context in Isaiah 6, we'll see that God is clearly making this as the statement of judgment, as a statement of judgment of the people's rebellion. They're turning away from God to worthless idols. So for Isaiah, the hardening was a punishment for their wrongdoing. But you will notice that John paraphrased Isaiah's quote of God's message. And this time the Septuagint closely matches the Hebrew. So it's not that, it's John's paraphrase. In Isaiah, God said, make the heart of this message dull, etc. Make the heart. John frames it a little differently when he says that God blinded their eyes, hardened their hearts, etc. He is emphasizing that the Jews could not believe because of God's sovereign choice to harden them. Now notice that I said emphasizing. I really think that is a key to understanding this issue. Here is an intriguing example from Paul with a different emphasis. And remember, Paul was writing to Gentiles. I find it fascinating how our Sunday school lesson is just a perfect tie-in here. John was writing this before the Gentile introduction to the church, and now Paul is writing this after that, and we have the sandwich here. Reading this, Romans 11, as regards the gospel, they, the Jews, are enemies for your sakes, you Gentiles' sakes. But as regards election, they are beloved for the sake of their forefathers, for the gifts and the calling of God are irrevocable. For just as you were at one time disobedient to God, but now have received mercy because of their disobedience, so they too have now been disobedient in order that by the mercy shown to you, they also may now receive mercy. Acts 10. For God has consigned all to disobedience, that he may have mercy on all. On all. Did you get that? The Jews were enemies of the gospel for the sake of the Gentiles. I'm still trying to wrap my mind around this dense paragraph, but ultimately Paul is saying that the hardening of both Jews and Gentiles was so that God could have mercy on all. Stop and let that soak. God is wanting to show mercy to all of us. If we have trouble with the idea of his hardening hearts, and most of us surely have or have had, if we have trouble with that, then note well that the purpose, the end goal, according to Paul, was to show mercy to all, so that all might be saved, John says. For God is not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. Or, for God so loved the world that whoever believes in him should not perish. Now, having said that, I do want to let John's emphasis in this passage stand front and center. He has highlighted the choices of people clearly. Some believed and some didn't. And now he explains that God hardened their hearts. In our human desire for the simplistic and easy, we just seem to always gravitate toward the either or. In this case, we must embrace the both and. Allow me to quote two men who to say concisely what I'm reaching for here. Alfred Plummer, grace may be refused so persistently as to destroy the power of accepting it. I will not leads to I cannot. And J.O.F. Murray, it is by God's appointment that if his word does not quicken, it must deaden. It is by God's appointment that if his word does not quicken, it must deaden. John has been doggedly building a platform to say that every person he wrote about, individually or collectively, was faced with a choice of belief that he could in no way dodge. So it is with every reader of the gospel. So it is with us. What will you do with Jesus? Neutral, you cannot be. So in John's bringing God's sovereignty in again, as he has so frequently done in the past, he is reminding us that our choice results in God's action. My final takeaway is a repetition here. Regarding man's choice and God's sovereignty, we must embrace both and. Let's kneel for prayer. I bless you, God, for another rich, full passage from the Gospel of John. I bless you for your Spirit that reveals the truths of this for us, that shows us the timelessness of it, that shows us what we do with it. Lord, I have tried to lay it out the best I know, but it has to be your Spirit at work in each of our lives individually going forward that really lets us embrace, apply, live out, integrate the truths that you've shown us here. Please do your work in our lives. In Jesus' name, amen.